All right, hello everyone and welcome back. My name is Savannah and I am the producer of the Roxburgh House Roundtables at Jefferson East Falls. Each episode is recorded and later posted on our YouTube and SoundCloud for those who were not able to make it to the live event. They are also aired on the first and third Sundays of each month from 8 to 9 a.m. on G-Town Radio 92.5 FM WGGT. For today's roundtable, joining us is Professor Bruce Haynes, Pennsylvania House Majority Leader Matt Bradford, Justin Kloss from the House Democratic Caucus Demographic Team, Esquire Pat Breer, and Esquire Don Breer. Today we will be discussing gerrymandering. Gerrymandering is the political manipulation of electoral district boundaries with the intent to create undue advantage for a party, group, or socioeconomic class within the constituency. And now I'll hand it over to Professor Evan Lane.
Thank you, Savannah. Thank you for all coming today. We really do appreciate you coming here. Savannah gave us a nice little beginning definition of gerrymandering, but I think it's best if we establish exactly what it is and how it's done. So let's start there.
So I will turn it over to an expert on the topic. Justin does this full-time for the House Democratic Caucus, and I think we've come a long way thanks to people like Justin who've kind of taken the best of the reform efforts to make sure that we get away from kind of the most insidious, weaponized use of the new technologies that exist to frankly, hotwire elections.
The old joke is only the other side gerrymanders. I've never gerrymandered in my life. I redistrict, I reapportion, but it is a process that has been fraught with abuse going back to Elbridge Gerry, who was, of course, the Massachusetts congressman who gave name to the process of gerrymandering. And of course, I mean, at the most basic level, redistricting is the process where once every 10 years we have United States Census. The results of those census are given out to the states, and we have to look at those results and then redistrict or change our legislative districts and our congressional districts in Washington, D.C. so they have almost equal population. So again, that happens once every 10 years, and it's a state legislative process. I always say state legislatures aren't the most sexy thing in the world, all the actions in Washington, D.C.
Speak for yourself.
We're on radio. Matt Bradford, he has a face for radio. But anyhow, every 10 years, the state legislature gets involved in this extremely partisan, we went through it in 2022. It's a brutal process. It's one of the most bare-knuckle political fights you can have in politics. And we go and we fight our Republican counterparts. There's two leaders from the House and Senate, Democratic, two leaders from the House and Senate, or Republican. And then we have a fifth neutral party who is generally supposed to be agreed upon by the other four, but never is. He's appointed by the Supreme Court if he can't be agreed upon. This fifth neutral party acts as a referee, and it's essentially an arbitration process where I come in with a map, the other guys come in with a map, and he picks what he thinks is best. And I can let the majority leader speak to what exactly went on last time, but it is a very brutal process. And it's been abused, I think, by one party going back to 1980, and we've ended up with a map that was, in fact, gerrymandered to the point where it was not possible for a Democratic majority to take place in the Pennsylvania House of Representatives for a good 20, 25 years. We maybe had 2 years of majority between 1994 and 2022. The 2022 redistricting process, for the first time since I've been in politics, 26 years, we have a fair map, a map where if you get 50% of the vote, you're going to get 50% of the seats in the legislature. Previously, it was 57%. For us to get 50% of the seats, for the Democrats to get a 102 of the 203 seats in the state legislature, you got to get 57% of the statewide vote. So to take, I'm sorry, go ahead.
Yes, okay, so let me break that down, because yes, a lot of people don't understand it. There are congressional districts,
yes,
in the state. So how many congressional
districts? We have 17 congressional districts. I want to say off the top of my head, we usually lose one every 10 years because population moves to the southern and western parts of the United States. So we have 17 congressional districts. It's a slightly different process. For congressional districts, we redistrict as a legislative bill, just like any other bill that passes the legislature. The Democrats will formulate a bill that has a map in it. The Republicans will formulate a bill that has a map in it. Majority rules. Whoever passes it, it becomes law instantaneously.
So let's break that between federal and state, because a lot of people get very confused,
yes,
on that.
Yes.
So it's sort of federal right now.
Yes.
That's congressmen that go to Congress.
Yes.
Okay. And there are 17 congressmen,
yes,
in PA.
Yes, okay. Each district about 760,000 people.
Okay, so each one has about that, and that makes a congressional district.
Correct.
So PA has 17 congressmen and two senators, so 19 votes, electoral votes total.
Correct. For the state. Correct.
Now, as far as let's talk state, as far as legislators, which you which we're talking about now,
right?
Is that the same districts, or are they different?
They are different districts. They are in the House. Of course, we have a House and the Senate, which reflects like Washington D.C. a bicameral legislature. In the House, we're looking at districts of about 64,000 people. And in the Senate, districts of about 260,000 people. So you have three levels of representation. You have your federal representation, congressman. Then you have state Senate, who represents a large district of 260,000 people. Then you have your state House members, like the majority leader, who represent 64,000 people. And there's 203 of those.
So as far as I'm understanding, there's three separate types of districts, then.
Yes.
The federal congressional, the state Senate, and the state Congress, I guess.
Correct.
Okay.
Yep, state
so
house.
You're actually drawing three separate maps then?
Three separate maps.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
Every 10 years.
Now, once we get that down, mm-hmm. now why does it make a difference? That's what we really want to get at.
Right.
Because what do you, because in my mind, if you don't know, if you have gerrymandering, you have squares across the, you know,
right.
somehow it's geographic that way, but it isn't that way.
Well, so. I would ask the question, what's important? What is important when you send a representative to Washington or Harrisburg? Who are they there to represent? Are they there to represent acres, trees? Are they there to represent people? Are they there to represent a community of interest, as we call it? Are they there to represent a municipality, a county? It's what's important. And I think that's been the struggle over the past 50 years of how do we redistrict by what's important.
So you have two, as I see it, two competing interests in all the three district plans. You have the interest of the people living there. But you have the interest of the party wanting to win a seat.
Correct.
Okay. So how do those two things come together, or how do they collide?
You've asked the question that's stumped the United States Supreme Court for 50 years.
Oh, go ahead, answer.
We're going to solve it right now. It's the Pennsylvania Constitution lays out an answer. And I have, I know you can't see this, we can put these slides online when you do your podcast, but we have about, I would say, four criteria that you want to follow no matter what. One of those is equality of population. In the past, all these districts, they didn't have equal population. I know back in the 1950s, 1940s, you had Forest County, Pennsylvania, had 6,000 people, had a legislative district. You had districts in Philadelphia County that had 80,000 people. So one guy goes to Harrisburg representing 6,000 people, one guy goes to Harrisburg representing 80,000 people. Mm-hmm. That's unfair representation. The 6,000 guy, he has much more power. Those people have more power than the 80,000 people in Philadelphia. Right. So Baker versus Carr was a court case in 1962 to establish what we call one person, one vote. All districts have to be the same size as near as possible. So that is the base foundation of redistricting. Both sides try to follow that as close as possible. It is foundational. So that's our first criteria. Second, in the Pennsylvania Constitution, a district should be compact and contiguous. What does compactness mean? No one knows. It's a word in the state constitution. It means whatever we want it to mean, essentially. Contiguous, a little easier, where we keep all the district has to touch the rest of the district. A third foundational tenet would be the Voting Rights Act. In the 1960s, of course, President Johnson passes the Voting Rights Act, which says in Section 2 that if you have a community, a minority community, it has to be given the chance to elect somebody of its choice. So, of course, there was a lot of abuse, particularly in the southern part of the United States, where you would take a community of African Americans and you would draw the district line right down the middle of that community to put a little bit of the community in one district, a little in the other, so they could never elect a representative of their choice. Voting Rights Act made that prohibited. And so now when we draw districts, I always say you've never met a Republican more supportive of minority voting rights than you do in redistricting, because they like to pack African Americans in one district to dilute that traditionally Democratic voting power. I think it was our argument in the past redistricting that you don't need 50% of African-Americans in a district to elect an African-American nowadays, and Democrats support spreading out the African-American vote, the Latino vote, to as many districts as possible to increase diversity.
So it's interesting. If you put a district, say you have a district of a lot of people of color, okay? If you have them in four different districts, they can influence the vote in four different districts.
Correct.
Instead of voting. But if you create one district, put them all in, then they only influence one district.
That's correct.
So what you've done is gained three districts.
That's, I think, you hit our philosophy in a nutshell.
Yeah, I think there's the argument between dilution and packet, right?
Right.
Like, they're the kind of, for a gerrymanderer, I would argue, they would argue they're the two tools, as though they are clearly inappropriate. Some would say, oh, you can dilute populations by making them in every community, but not enough to be impactful in any community.
Right.
Conversely, you say, hey, look, we're going to cut our losses. Instead of them being impactful in four, we'll make them packed into 100% of one. And both of those extremes, obviously, are prohibitive.
And there are weird people like me who sit in the basement or the attic of the state capitals of this country who can go in and analyze the voting behavior of these minorities to see if it has what we call racially polarized voting. Will white people only vote for black people in this or white people in this district, or will white people vote for black people and white people in this district? And we give that analysis to the courts to basically show, look, in the 3rd Congressional District of Alabama, white people will not vote for a black candidate, so you are diluting this African-American population and disenfranchising them from having any political power. And so you can get very technical. I think recently the courts have been very friendly to us on it, because I think, you know, it's not only is it illegal, but it's the right thing to do to give these people a voice.
I think you've been talking, both of you, about weaponizing gerrymandering. So you get more definitive about what does that mean, how is it done, and why is it done?
What I explained there earlier was the constitutional basis of redistricting. Now, what is gerrymandering? There's one other very, very important thing we're allowed to look at. The United States Supreme Court will not take a view on whether what we do is right or wrong, and that's looking at political data. Every time I pull up a map, some parts are going to be red, some parts are going to be blue. And when I draw a district, what weight do I give to the constitutional requirements? What weight do I give to the political requirements? And again, the United States Supreme Court will not take a stand on it. So as of right now, perfectly legal for us to sit down and draw a district that's just blue. If there's a red part, I can cut it right out and just include the blue parts. It's completely legal. Is it right? No. Is it fair? It's not.
That was a case that recently went to the Supreme Court, whether there could be a federal judiciable standard for what was partisan gerrymandering. And the conservative Supreme Court said that basically it's a free fire zone. Now, having said that, our state constitution has a free and fair election provision, which speaks very clearly in Pennsylvania, and our, I would argue, more enlightened Supreme Court has taken a much more jaundiced view of partisan redistricting efforts.
That's absolutely correct. That's absolutely correct.
Let me go back one second, just kind of level set to the point you made earlier about the federal versus the state. So a lot of the driver of all of this is the census data. You know, so people like Justin could never make the case and put together the argument without seeing change in the demographics. So if I have this correct, I think Pennsylvania has 67 counties. I think 42 of the counties lost population.
That's not about right.
Right? Most of those counties were probably red, you know, starting with the Susquehanna going west. So that gave us, at the same time, going into this redistricting, there were 113 Republicans and 90 Democrats, which is really out of kilter, because this is a state that, you know, every election, for except for the outliers like Shapiro's most recent, is a close electoral state. So it's really weird to have one side really lopsided over the other. So when we started this process, particularly with his, you know, skill set, you went back, and the other point I'd make is, and this is from the leader, we were allowed to hire really high-end experts to come in and bring in the data. And I'll ask Dan to talk a little bit about Dr. Barreto, but, you know, from UCLA. But that gave us the starting point to say, look, we have to make this fair. I mean, at the end of the day, that's what the message that came out of the leader's office was, we want a fair map. And at the end, so right now it's 102-99 in favor of the Democrats, compared to 113-90 is where we started. So if you want to, you know, talk a little bit about the experts.
Sure. So going back to where you started, Professor, the essence of gerrymandering, as the Supreme Court said, is do the voters get to pick their representatives, or do the representatives get to pick the voters? Gerrymandering is when the representatives pick the voters to embed either a majority or their re-election. as Justin said, the Pennsylvania Constitution has some neutral criteria. The neutral criteria that the Constitution requires are that the districts be equal in population, that they be compact, and that they be contiguous. Now, the exercise itself is like an exercise in geometry, because the standard is that you cannot divide cities, towns, boroughs, municipalities, but it's absolutely impossible to draw 203 districts for the Pennsylvania House of Representatives without dividing some of them. So the real exercise is a tension between the stakeholders, the Republicans on one side and the Democrats on the other, who are using the information available to them to try to develop a plan that meets the neutral criteria, but also is one that will get the support of a majority of the commission. So the plan only becomes law if it gets 3 out of 5 votes. As Justin said at the beginning, and this is in state redistricting, there are 2 Democratic representatives under the Constitution and 2 Republican representatives. And then there's a 5th, and in this case it was the former Chancellor of the University of Pittsburgh, Chancellor Nordenberg, who was the 5th member. So there's this super interesting dynamic where law and politics intersect, and the effort is to, of course, develop a plan that's constitutional, but also one that wins the support of the 3rd vote. And the plan that passed in 2021, which is now the law, actually won the support of 4 of the 5 members. The majority leader of the Senate, Kim Ward, supported the plan, along with both Democrats and the neutral Chancellor Nordenberg. Now, just briefly on Pat's question, there's a whole highly refined area of social science around map analysis, and there's different arguments about what metrics are the best metrics to determine whether a map is fair or not. Justin used what I consider to be the gold standard. If you get 50% of the votes statewide, it's pretty easy to argue that the party that gets 50% of the votes should get pretty damn close to 50% of the seats. And if you see it skewed one way or the other, where you can get 50% of the votes with 42%, I'm sorry, 50% of the seats with 42% of the votes, it smells. Uh-huh. That doesn't pass the smell test. Uh-huh. If you have to get 57% of the votes statewide to get 50% of the seats, it sounds like you're fighting uphill. It sounds like you're starting from a real disadvantage. This current map, as Pat said, is there's 102 democratically elected members and 101 Republican, which really does reflect pretty much the balance of politics in the state.
And, for good or for bad.
Yeah, but it makes governing hard because you have absolutely no margin for error if something is being decided on partisan grounds. But the social scientists, you see them in all the big cases. There's a small stable of social scientists. Some typically appear on the side of Republicans, some typically appear on the side of Democrats, and then there's some that the courts often appoint. And those social scientists use really sophisticated algorithms and data to test whether a map is fair or not. And that's really what gerrymandering comes down to. Is it fair at the end of the day, or are you favoring particular constituency, a particular party over the other?
So I have a couple questions on that. So you have this 5-person panel
right.
looking at things. Does the legislature then have to vote on it after they agree or three agree to
no.
it? Or is it, that's it?
It has to be approved by the Supreme Court.
Okay.
Well, on the state side. On the state side, when you're doing the state Senate and the state House,
right.
once the map has the support of a majority of the commission.
Five.
Mm-hmm. It is the map. Now, under the Constitution, there's a right to appeal that map to the Supreme Court. Of the state Supreme Court. And that appeal follows like Sunday follows Saturday, because somebody's unhappy mm-hmm. with the way that worked out. And this past cycle, the same thing happened. There was an appeal by the leader, Benninghoff, who was on the commission, who was the dissenting vote. He appealed to the Pennsylvania Supreme Court. And the Pennsylvania Supreme Court heard extensive briefing. I brought some of it with us today. And everybody weighed in, including amicus parties and other stakeholders. And at the end of the day, the Supreme Court found the plan to be constitutional.
So that brings to the next question. You're talking about the 50-50, and that makes perfect sense. That has to be as close as possible because it sounds pretty logical to me. But that wasn't what was happening.
Right.
Okay. And so recently, I remember reading and preparing for this that Pennsylvania, several previous years, was looked at as perhaps one of the worst states regarding unfair or weaponized gerrymandering. Mm-hmm. So how'd that happen?
Yeah. So I can speak from some personal experience. So I had a district, and you know, Dee Bruce, you know this well.
Yeah.
So Montgomery County, my district, I live in Worcester Township. For anyone who knows Montgomery County geography, it's kind of an obscure township. It's beautiful. It's a great place, but it's somewhere between Bluebell and Skipack, in the middle of our county. But the only reason why I lived in the district I lived, because they created a district that bisected the borough of Norristown, largely a minority population center. At that point, Republicans controlled the redistricting. They took half of Norristown and sent that district all the way up past Vernfield, which is part of the Salverton School District, Lower Salford, northwest corner of Montgomery County. Took the other part of Norristown and split it out all the way, I think, past Limerick. So all the way out 422. So the borough of Norristown was split into these long pooled districts way out into the nether regions of the county. And the idea was it would elect two Republicans. And it performed as the, I don't want to say gerrymander, but as the folks that were gerrymandering intended it to. Montgomery County, in the period of time I got elected in 2008, Montgomery County was quickly moving blue, but probably never was going to move quickly blue enough for a Democrat to ever win those seats. And then what happened was in 2008, Barack Obama ran. There was historic turnout in the borough of Norristown. I would like to think I was an amazing candidate, but I'm not so delusional. But we had a strongly moving Democratic wave in Montgomery County. We had a strong party. They put a lot of resources. And I believe in that year I was one of the, I think I may be the only Democrat to defeat a Republican incumbent in that district. Now I will tell you, in 2010, the belief was a Democrat could not get reelected in that seat because it had been so skewed. And, you know, elections have consequences, so Democrats had lost legislative elections, but it becomes cyclical because if you lose control of the legislature, you likely lose control of the redistricting process, and the Supreme Court elections, who appoint the fifth member to the commission, are very important to this as well. So you had this thing. So when my district got redistricted in 2012, the first time I was going to see a redistricting, I was going to be out of my seat, basically. At that time, the majority was going to take my area. It was a Republican red area in Montgomery County. They very much wanted to put my home area into another seat, and I would have likely been out of the legislature. At that time, Republicans, the trend, the Republican Supreme Court, it was Supreme Court Justice Castile at the time. He actually started, I think, the process, a Republican, who recognized this had gotten way out of control and said, some of this is too extreme. They threw the map out. I was one of those people who got a reprieve. My seat was put back together to some extent that I was able to survive to the next 10 years. But my district was largely packed. At that point, they took all the borough of Norristown, put it together, put as many Democrats as humanly possible. I went from a marginally Republican seat to an overwhelmingly Democratic seat. One who knows, you know, Montgomery County would know that Worcester, central Montgomery County, is not a community of interest necessarily with the borough of Norristown, but that was the way it was put together, as this Frankenstein seat to kind of deal with what I'll call the first wave of reform in the redistricting movement. I will tell you, when the Supreme Court elected a very new, fresh crop of jurists, I guess in the 2015 election, they took a whole much more strenuous view of the constitutional requirements that Justin laid out. And in the most recent redistricting, they really wanted to see they wanted to see some commitment to those constitutional provisions that had been missing. And I think that the nature of who was on the court, what they were requiring, and the trend that had come, frankly, from the Castile court forward, and I think also civic engagement. There was a recognition that this gerrymandering, because it had become so weaponized, and I often say, not that gerrymandering was great in the days of the founding fathers, it used to be an incumbent protection measure largely. I think if you read some of the books whose names are famous because they're not particularly pleasant, but who wrote about Operation Red Map and kind of the beginning of the Republican effort to institutionalize control of state legislatures, you had a real pushback that recognized it had been weaponized not for the benefit of incumbency, which is bad enough, but had been weaponized for ideological or partisan political reasons. You had all of those forces come together nationally at the local level. The difference of what was happening in our state court all came together for a perfect storm for what I would argue is such a fair map that we now sit at 102, 101, literally trying to govern through probably, and by the way, a 102, 101 map at a time where, you know, Governor Shapiro was winning election in that election by 15 points. So it's such an ethically fair map. It actually, in some of the measures, I think is actually slightly Republican-leaning.
That raises other questions. So the Supreme Court picks the fifth party, the so-called neutral. The Supreme Court in PA is elected.
Yes.
Not appointed. Okay. Mm-hmm. So there's obviously partisan policies involved. So if you have a one leaning area, obviously the neutral is going to be leaning most likely that way.
But I would tell you this. First of all, I think there's a misunderstanding that that an appointed court versus an elected court. My experience is, and I say this as an attorney, a good jurist, that really is checked at the door. Who you're appointed by, you know, I know, you know, President Trump did this whole thing once, we were talking about, that's a Democratic judge. That stuff needs to be checked at the door. The current court was, again, I would say, Mark Nordenberg is probably much regarded as apolitical, a human being as there is. And when it comes to his commitment to those reform credentials, it's pretty strong. Having said that, people will make the point as you write.
In 2012, we had a Republican-appointed chairman of the commission. We had a Republican Supreme Court, and the plan was thrown out by the Republican Supreme Court. We had to go back and do it for a second time. So I think that's correct. I think the jurists will default to the law first and politics second, and that's been the experience so far.
So what I'm trying to understand is this. Why are the Democrats looking for a fair map when the previous history of the other party was not?
Having a boot on your neck long enough makes you appreciate fairness.
Yeah, that's a good way to put it. We were looking at a history of, I've been doing this since 2000. One other guy has done it for the Democrats since it started in 1971. 71, 81, relatively fair. Like Matt said, starting in 91, the Republican Party really emphasized the importance of winning state legislative chambers to control redistricting. It was a smart political move on their part. So starting in 1991, they really began intensifying this effort to draw districts that benefited them. And you mentioned how we ended up almost famous nationwide. There's the famous congressional district they passed in 2001, Goofy Kicking Donald Duck. Just an insane district. I mean, at one point, it was down in Delaware County. At one point, it is exactly one steakhouse parking lot wide. The district is a parking lot wide. On this side is a Democrat. On this side is a Democrat. The Republican district goes through, I forget the name of the steakhouse, but it goes right through the parking lot. It spreads out and gets every Republican in Delaware and Chester County, and that is it.
Creed Steakhouse, I believe.
Creed Steakhouse.
Yeah, that's what. I just throw one thing into it. A lot of, going back to the motive of what drives this, is it has to be a lot of political courage to take. It's a lot easier just to have an incumbent protection plan, even when you're in the minority. Because a lot of your friends and colleagues are in comfortable districts. They have a very high performing, you know, DPIs, they call it. And so when Leader and Speaker McClinton and Jordan Harris made the decision to really put a team on the field and really go for a fair map. A lot of your own colleagues were, kind of threatened a little bit by saying, I get reelected by 58% every time, and this map that Justin, we all blamed it on you, but this map that Justin came up with, like, I'm down to a 54% performing district versus a 58. And so self-interest kicked in a little bit. So it took a lot of courage, I think, for a leadership of the Democratic Party, who was very much in the minority at the time, to really say, look, we're going for it. We're going to hire the right lawyers, we're going to hire the right experts, we're going to explain to all of our members that elections have consequences. And so right now, I think we have the only split legislature in the country, right? Mm-hmm. Governor Shapiro was pointing this out the other night, so we have a Democratic House and Republican Senate, Democratic governor. And last year was bumpy, but this year hopefully it won't be as bumpy, but take something like Act 77, like one of the mail-in vote crisis that we still have in the state. One of the reasons that's still a crisis is because of early canvassing, which is not allowed in Pennsylvania. So you're not allowed, all the mail-in votes are not allowed to be pre-sorted and pre-counted so that when 8 o'clock hits on election night, they automatically get tallied. What we had in the last election, as we all know, was this rampant conspiracy theory that 3 or 4 days later, we still don't know what happened. Well, the truth is, they weren't allowed to count until the polls closed, and that's, we still don't have that solved in Pennsylvania, correct?
Correct, yeah.
But political leadership and guts really allowed a lot of the team to perform their job, but it's, you can speak to having to tell members you're not going to win by 58, you're going to win by 54. Yeah.
Fairness requires fair districts, and that's, good people have to exercise good leadership, but you can get used to being in the minority. There is a comfort level to having a very few, very safe seats. But it defeats democracy, and it also, for those who want to ever see elections actually determine the will of the people, to reflect the will of the people, it also can defeat the will of the people. So you've got to get everyone out of their comfort level. And that's part of the breaking China that was required to get out of the old gerrymandered maps. It required tremendous changes into the maps. There were incumbent members that were taken out of their seat and no longer lived in their district. I believe actually the Democrat who lived in this district, her seat was changed dramatically. She was unable to win her seat. It created huge disruption. Now going forward, hopefully it'll be more based on population shift, not so much about remedying past gerrymandering.
And to go back to something Representative Bradford said, again, this, like I said, this is a bare-knuckle political process. It's been done behind closed doors throughout history. Look how long it took us to explain how it worked. Mm-hmm. Many people, they had no idea of the process. They didn't pay attention to the process. We did it behind closed doors. We cut, backroom deals in the past, and nobody paid attention. I don't want to sound Pollyannish. I've been in politics for almost 40 years, but people paid attention. Voters started paying attention. Like you said, it got so egregious. Yeah. And the fair district movement rose up, and we had so many people coming to Harrisburg, coming to hearings, and politicians will always tell you the one thing they're most scared of is the voters. The voters were paying attention. You can't get away with this crap. You're one steakhouse parking lot wide when voters are paying attention. This is the first time it ever happened, and we got a map that's fair.
But do you feel if the numbers change, if there's a red wave, for example, do you feel that the Supreme Court justice you've told us about who is no longer there, whatever it may be, do you feel the other party will just be as fair-minded as you have been in order to just make sure that things are done right, or
they're kind
not?
Of bad, aren't they?
I don't have a crystal ball, and I don't know that. I mean, listen, there is an anti-democratic movement right now in the other party, and I don't mean to be horribly partisan about that, but it is scary, the amount of people that will look at election suppression, voter suppression things. This is one of the things that adds to that concern. One would argue that, these things were the opening salvos of that. The Republican Party has an obligation to stand up to those voices in their party. I love my party. I want my party to win. I believe in democratic principles, but I believe democracy supersedes the my desire that Democrats win. I mean, that's as simple as, I always said, the thing that I found so troubling, and I know we're off on a different topic if you get to go down this rabbit hole, but I always said, like, the craziest thing about the 2020 election for me was, I ran an election, I mentioned 2010, I thought I was gonna lose. I was fully convinced I was gonna have to call at 8 p.m. to concede my election. The idea that you would have an election and not concede and not recognize, hey, the will of the people have been heard, that's what we do. You thank the people for voting for you, and you recognize the will of the people. Whether it's election denial or hyper-partisan gerrymandering, it's very alarming for those of us who, while we support our party, love our country first and foremost.
It's extremely refreshing to hear that. And we're in the All-Inspector Center, and there's a reason why I asked that question. Inspector was a Republican, as you well know, and then Obama was elected to office, and at that point, many of the Republican Party said, whatever he wants, we're against, even though we're suffering from the worst economic disaster since 1929. He switched parties to vote for the Obama Act in order to bring our economy back, and he was thrown out of the party, essentially. So what you're talking about is what's in the best interest of the voter, what's in the best interest of the Commonwealth of PA, where in that situation, it didn't matter. So I see a dichotomy in parties, and I'm just seeing, you know, four gentlemen in front of me said, we want to do what is fair. And I just want to know if you feel confident that the other side wants to do what is fair.
I'm confident that if they don't, they'll end up in court. And I'm confident that when their conduct is measured against existing case law, like in 2018, the Pennsylvania Supreme Court gave new meaning to the Free and Equal Elections Clause in the Pennsylvania Constitution. It had been essentially a dormant clause in the Constitution, and they looked at the congressional maps, and at that time there were 18 seats, and I think 13 were Republican and 5 were Democrat, and they looked at the Free and Equal Clause and said people are being denied their right to free and equal elections, and they threw the map out. And the subsequent map that came in, even though we lost a seat, is 9-8. So it went from 13-5 to 9-8. And I think we went from 0 women in the congressional delegation to 5 women, all in a matter of, I think, 2 or 3 election cycles. So am I confident they'll be fair? No. But I'm confident they'll be held to account if they're not fair. And that's why Leader Bradford brought in lawyers who do this kind of work, who operate in that space. They have lawyers too. To go back to one earlier question that you had, and I think it was a really probing question, don't they want to win, and don't you want to win? And sort of what's the governing factor there? What holds back the desire to sort of overreach? At least in the state system, what polices that, what holds it back, is you have to win the vote of the third, of the neutral member. And if you're too greedy, if you reach too far, and if the leader had drawn up a map that said, okay, we don't want a map that gives us 50-50 representation, we want one that gives us 57-43, I'm confident Leader Nordenberg would have rejected the map. And we wouldn't be sitting here. You'd have other people sitting here telling you about why they were successful. So there is that sort of inherent, and that's the wisdom of the way the Constitution is written. The Pennsylvania Constitution is the instrument that says there will be 5 members of this commission, 2 partisan Democrats, 2 partisan Republicans, and a 5th member. That 5th member is a heavy burden, right? Because as you know, they have a lot of authority. But also, our responsibility was to put something forward that he could defend and say, this is credible. And he wrote a report, I have it on my lap, that he filed publicly on March 4 of 2022, that's 75 pages. His own report defending the judgments of the legislative body, or the reapportionment commission. So it's easy to say, let's reach for the stars, but you're not going to get anything if you do that. And I think that's the policing factor. Justin may have a different view.
I agree with what Dan said there on the state legislative, but however, for congressional, for our guys we send to Washington, D.C., it's the Wild West.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Because, again, it's just a legislative, it's just a bill. It's just a legislative process. So if you have a majority in the House and majority in the Senate, you can put through your sixth congressional district, which is one steakhouse parking lot wide.
You have to get the governor's signature.
The governor
has to sign. And you get the governor's signature.
So let's get that done. So I think you've done a great job of explaining the state system with the five and so forth, but if you're going to change the congressional federal, that's just done in D.C. and Congress.
No, it's done in Pennsylvania, but
as the lower house.
Yeah, it's the legislative process. It's like passing the budget, or it's like passing any other piece of legislation we pass on a daily basis. Majority rules, if it passes by one vote in the House and the Senate, it goes to the governor. He signs it. Those are your congressional districts. Of course, still subject to judicial review. But, you know, the process was really abused in 2000.
Well, if you have one party controlling all three branches, in that cycle you had a Republican Senate, Republican House, and a Republican governor, mm-hmm. and you ended up with a congressional map that had 13 Republicans and 5 Democrats. This, now that you have a Democratic House and a Republican Senate and a Democratic governor, there has to, you know, there's more balance that sort of prevents that.
One of the reasons why I'm so glad we're having this today is we have two systems in our country which control power, which I would say the huge majority of our citizens have no clue. The first is the Electoral College, which if you ask people on the street, you're going to get some really weird things. And setting a district of gerrymandering is the other. And that's why we're holding us today, is to educate. So we understand, because what we don't understand, that's when people don't end up voting. Because they'll say, it doesn't matter, it's all set before, and we get 50% of people not even bothering to vote. So other than, of course, coming here today, which is a great thing, and we'll publicize it, how do you get the word out on this?
It's a great question. Young people, so you're on a college campus, getting young people to understand it is an obligation. I go back to, you know, you read the Federalist Papers if you haven't already in your government classes. All of that is based on an informed, committed electorate. And if I'll be really honest, and again, I don't want to go back on the Trump thing, but I think one of the things that we kind of lost sight of is democracy is a participation sport. Everyone's got a role to play. Yes, it's to vote, but it's to be informed. And in an era where you're getting bombarded by the crazy social media, which isn't always, it's not really news. In many cases, it's the conspiracies, it's that. And then you have some of our elected officials that I think have checked their responsibility to their democracy at the door. It makes it harder. So it requires all of us to buy into what our founding fathers gave us. They were not perfect. This system is not perfect. You can argue about the Electoral College, but it is the rule. It's the rules. It's the rule of the road. We have an obligation to do that. We have an obligation whether you're an 18-year-old or an 80-year-old. Get involved. Do your part. Vote. But be an intelligent voter. Be a smart voter. I say this all the time. I speak to young Republican groups, even though I'm a Democrat. You know, you talked about Arlen Specter. We need good Republicans just like we need good Democrats. Neither side has monopoly on good ideas or good people. There's no monopoly on righteousness. We need people who believe in the system, who believe in their country. Again, I do believe in the Democratic Party. I've spent my whole adult life like these guys working for the Democratic Party. We're happy to engage the partisan fight, but love of country goes ahead of love of party.
Just like to know if they knew or felt comfortable, you have to give your name, on what gerrymandering was before today. I'm on point, won't use a name.
I was fairly familiar with it. One of our adjuncts, Henry Buhner, explained it, I think, pretty well in our one of the classes that he teaches. I was familiar that it was a term, obviously, with a negative connotation that referred to the drawing of congressional districts. So,
I have no idea. I heard about it and I like I saw like it had a negative connotation, but I did not know what it meant. So
do you now?
Yeah.
Not at all.
Uh-oh.
We were actually, it was our last unit in American Gov that we just had to finish a unit assignment on, and I hadn't known about it before, but now after doing research for the assignment, I was learning more about it, and I just wanted to hear people who do the job learn about it.
Yeah, I heard about gerrymandering, understood it mostly, but I didn't know like the complexities behind it and the like partisan effort to fight it.
For me, it was the same thing as what you said. We did that in American Gov, and with more research, it's becoming more clear, and after today, it's really clear. But before that, I basically had no idea what it was.
I had a good understanding of it. Obviously, as Ryan mentioned, we learned about it compared to legal systems. It's interesting, I think, to hear about sort of the people and the stories behind some of these things and how intense it can really get.
I have a quick anecdote for you. The very beginning of this process, now Speaker McClinton and Leader Bradford were interviewing people, and they called our law firm and they asked us what our view of prison gerrymandering is. And to be 100% honest, I had no idea what prison gerrymandering was. But since it was important to the people who are making the decision, we took a swing at the question. But here's what's interesting about it. Prison gerrymandering was something that this Legislative Reapportionment Commission addressed for the first time in the history of the country. What did they do? They said, generally, prisons are in more rural districts. And for purposes of counting the number of people in the district, the history had been to count the prisoners where they are imprisoned.
Even though they don't vote.
Even though they don't vote, and even though they have a last known address of where they resided before they went to prison. So Speaker McClinton, as her first initiative, pressed the commission and the chairman, Nordenberg, to address that problem. And I think it really set an atmosphere for the entire process because it forced an active debate and study of the issue. And where the commission landed was they decided to count prisoners not where they're housed in prison, but at their last known address, unless they had more than 10 years left to serve on their sentence. Because if they had more than 10 years left, they'd still be in that prison at the next reapportionment, which is really rational. And at the end of the day, I don't think it mattered a great deal in terms of how the maps were drawn, but it mattered in terms of the accountability of the process. And I just think it was, I've been doing this a long time. I'd never heard of it. I took a swing at the question when we were asked, and I'm sure I missed. But Pat has been in this intersection of law and politics, you know, his whole career as well. And I just think that's the kind of thing that when you get fair-minded new thinkers in the process, you know, you get that kind of an outcome, which is really unique. Do you know, Justin, how many people it ended up reapportioning?
I think it was 7,000 total. But again, like you said, it was good for the process, and it was just the right thing to do. Again, after 150 years of doing our best to disenfranchise the poorest, racial minorities, any sort of group that's not, you know, overwhelmingly white men, we made this move to fix that. Because where do prisoners come from generally? From your poorer areas, from more minority areas. And so you're giving more political power to the whitest, oldest, least populated areas of Pennsylvania. You're taking away from the fastest growing, some of the most dynamic areas of Pennsylvania. You're taking political power away from it. And it was the right thing to do. And I could have never thought, having done this since 2000, I could have never imagined that we'd be able to do something like that. And it was just the idea, mm-hmm. You know? It was just broaching the idea and working out, and we did it. And that was the first of many things we did for the first time.
Going back to a point you made earlier about the importance, like sometimes you can get cynical and say, my vote doesn't count for the Electoral College. I think we'd all agree, everybody in this room, that Pennsylvania If it never mattered before, it really matters this time. Okay, because there are a handful of states that are going to really determine this election. That's why for the last week you saw President Biden. He came up through the Lehigh Valley, spent 2 days in Scranton. He flew to Pittsburgh yesterday for 2 days. He's, I think, in Philadelphia today, isn't he?
Yeah.
Anyway, but it is all about the base, you know, and turnout. And there's a, in the political world, this is one of those elections that's not really a persuasion election. Because most people who have an opinion, it's pretty much fixed at this point. It's about who gets their vote up. And so to everybody in this room and every college campus, I'd recommend, you know, being active, like campus, you know, just registration, early voting, but your vote, it really, truly does, Pennsylvania really does matter this time.
It mattered last time.
And it did matter, we sure did.
As well.
Yeah.
We have only a couple of minutes left, so I just want to ask one more question if anyone else wants to ask a question after it. Have you run into voters who have been in these Frankenstein-type districts and feel that they have been purposely discriminated against?
Well, I lived in the, most people were shocked, the Mickey Mouse kicking Donald Duck. I lived in that district, and people couldn't believe that that was, that our congressman was, it was Pat Meehan at the time, who was in Delaware County. Somehow it came up through central Montgomery County, one of those tentacles. I mean, it was an absurd time. Montgomery County, again, you know, I meant it was an ascendant blue area, and all of a sudden we went from the old 13th Congressional, which you know well, and was a, you know, it was the Montgomery County district. And then we quickly just found ourselves, we were torn seven different ways, I think, in that gerrymander. So nobody knew, there was no sense of community, you didn't know who your representative was, you have no accountability in that. So having lived through it, absolutely, it was obvious. I mean, no one knew who their congressman was at that point.
We went through, 12 hours of public hearings of people coming to Harrisburg with their own maps that they made in their house, showing us, you know, here's where I live, here's the next district. So, again, first time we sat through that much public testimony from
Can you mention Dave's redistricting a little bit for this group? Because you're all politically engaged.
Yeah, because it used to be in the past, I would have a, when I first started, the computer system cost $100,000 to draw a map. And then it cut down maybe $5,000. Now you can do it. You can go to daysredistricting.com, and you can draw the exact same map I can draw, all the same data. So the power has been diffused. Anybody can draw a map now. That's going to keep me more honest when I draw my map.
You also mentioned hearings. Chairman Nordenberg did all those hearings. But even I remember the Republican policy went out, and they were obviously not a huge fan of the hearings, but they pointed out that McCandless needed to be put back together, which was a town in western Pennsylvania. And Sheridan Nordenberg, I mean, he would take in testimony from everybody and anybody. And sometimes it was impossible. I mean, it just couldn't be done, or it didn't actually make sense. But I remember he was committed to, like, okay, we'll try to put this community back together. And there was, you know, many times where those issues were raised. Again, it's never going to be perfect. But if your principles are guided by something higher than just party, you'll be well served.
I think that's a great final statement to make. Does anyone have a question before we wrap up?
I just had a real quick question. So I've lived in Philadelphia for my whole life, and I feel like as a city kid, there's a sort of divide in the way that rural kids and city kids are taught about these type of things, especially politics. I feel like as a city kid, I've only ever learned about city politics, and even that was very, very small. I feel like in rural areas, when I speak to people from, you know, like farther in Pennsylvania, maybe Freedom's PA or something like that, they know a lot more about city politics and their own politics than I know nothing about theirs. In your opinions, do you guys think that, you know, is there a way to rectify this? Is there something that we can do as city children and college university students to make a difference in there?
So Philly City Council casts a big shadow. And I think Philadelphia Channel 3610, you know, they cover Philly City Council. It's very Philly-centric. Even as the suburbanites, they don't really cover our suburban county commissioner meetings or anything like that. I go back to, you know, the rise of the information media being so different. The downside is, you know, news media doesn't have as reach that it used to. The local newspapers don't have the reach that it used to. The other side is you do have organically some alternative media rising up to cover it. There are, one of the challenges, going back to just the press, is not as vibrant as it once was, and a vibrant press and an informed citizenry is so important, all those things we talked about earlier. It is a real concern. Some of it is economic, some is new technology, some of it's geographic, some of it's just, you know, myopic, looking at, you know, what we know locally. It is a real challenge, and there's not a great, there's no one great answer. I think the answer goes back to being an informed citizenry that really wants to go out and actively goes out and gets that information.
I really want to thank you both for coming today. This has been incredibly informative, instructional, and hopefully people will listen and learn. And again, thank you so much. Thank you to Professor Haynes for setting this up. We greatly appreciate it, and all of you. And of course, you, Leader Bradford, thank you so much for coming today.
Thank you all so much for coming in and talking about gerrymandering and the manipulation surrounding it. It's so important for us to keep talking about these topics to change society's normal and to further inform and educate others about it. Thank you to Bruce Haynes, Matt Bradford, Justin Kloss, Pat Breer, and Don Breer for hosting this event. And again, we post our roundtables on our YouTube and SoundCloud, and we are broadcasted on the first and third Sundays of each month from 8 to 9 a.m. on G-Town Radio, 92.5 FM WGGT. Thanks for listening, and have a great day.